We are going to discuss the issues raised by the weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, when a white supremacist rally turned violent. One person was killed and 19 others injured when an Ohio man drove his car into a group of counter-demonstrators. President Trump condemned all sides for the violence and is facing criticism for saying many sides were to blame instead of condemning the white supremacy movement. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. What is your reaction to what happened in Charlottesville? What do you make of the president's response? What can be done about hate and extremism in America? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest who is joining us on fairly short notice. Cynthia Miller Idris is an associate professor of education and sociology at American University, where, among other things, she researches extremism. Her forthcoming book is The Extreme Gone Mainstream. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot for being with us. First off, your reaction when you first heard about the violence in Charlottesville.
My reaction was, it's incredibly distressing, but I personally was not surprised. I think it's the culmination of an ongoing escalation of radicalism and extremism that we've been seeing over the past year in the United States. So it wasn't surprising, but of course it's distressing and was terrible to see the violence and ultimately the death.
Yeah. Let's just kind of backtrack a little bit for those who weren't paying very close attention. One of the initial aims of the white supremacist rally was to protest the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from a local park. How do we go from that to what ended up happening?
Well, I think the removal of the statue becomes kind of a focal point for a whole host of other of the far right and the right wing extremist white supremacist movements, kind of emotions and senses of anger that have really been kind of unleashed and legitimized over the past year by campaign rhetoric, by kind of public conversation and a sense that this is that this is now legitimate or valid to feel kind of a sense of loss of identity. And so that statue removal became, in many ways, I don't think it was about the statue at all. It's just the statue becomes the central focal point and organizing point to rally around to say, like, look, this is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. We're losing our identity. That's the kind of emotional underpinning of it.
Yeah, can you speak to who the rally attendees were? We hear alt-right, neo-Nazis, white nationalists. Who was there and why is it important?
Yeah, I think part of why this particular rally was so important is because it was called Unite the Right. It's a kind of rally that was designed to bring together a fragmented set of movements that include, you know, kind of the alt-right, which is a kind of rebranding of white nationalism, but includes a whole bunch of kind of fringe groups and was an attempt to kind of unite lots of smaller splinter groups around this one focal point, which is the removal of the Confederate statue. But it's not, it's an effort to kind of start to build a more coherent extremist right-wing movement in the U.S., I think.
Yeah. This morning, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told ABC News that this instance of a man ramming his car into a crowd of counter-demonstrators, killing one and injuring many others, meets the definition of domestic terrorism. What do you think is the importance of using that label of domestic terrorism?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think that it's exactly the kind of language we need to hear. I think that there has been certainly over the last year and a half, a separation of white supremacist violence, white nationalist violence from Islamist terror, Islamist-motivated terror, jihadi terror. We've seen that in the recommendations of the Trump administration to not include white supremacy in the countering violent extremism funding for the Department of Homeland Security. They've defunded one of the major anti-white supremacist, anti-neo-Nazi programs that was originally funded through the Department of Homeland Security. So I think that it's really, really important to see that kind of language coming in to equate the kinds of things that happened in 1995 in Oklahoma City, the Dylann Roof shooting, these kinds of acts of violence by neo-Nazi right-wing extremists, white supremacists, with the kind of terror acts committed by jihadist or Islamist terror groups. I think we need to see that kind of equation.
When the news broke of this death and this act of what is now being called domestic terrorism occurred in Charlottesville, President Trump was criticized by members of both parties for not condemning what happened in Charlottesville in strong enough terms.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. It's been going on for a long, long time.
So, Cynthia, what do you make of the criticism of President Trump saying that that many, many sides are to blame for what's been going on?
Yeah, I think there's completely valid criticism. I think that it was not forceful enough a statement. I think that, you know, while on the one hand we have seen, I think what's unique in the last year in the States is we're seeing the kind of escalation of violence from the left and the right that you've seen in Europe for many years among young people, with kind of clashes of anti-fascist and fascist protesters in Europe. We're now seeing that in the States, and that's new. So in that sense, yes, there is in general more violence from the left and from the right than we have seen. But in this particular case, I don't think you can see a situation where there was a deliberate act of terror, of violence that resulted in the death of a young person and not call that out for what it is, which was a violent murder that came from one motivated side. So I think, you know, there was an escalation of violence over the past year, and he's right about that, but there should have been a forceful statement against the particular act of violence that occurred.
Yeah, President Trump said that phrase on many sides twice on Saturday. What does that convey to protesters, to counter-protesters, to the people watching? We heard that some leader on the alt-right said, good, he didn't condemn us specifically.
Yeah, it was absolutely celebrated by the extreme right. The statement was saying he's not condemning us. I think Fox News ran a quote showing that, you know, that statement. It's it was clearly seen as received by the far right as a kind of further legitimation of the violence that's been escalating. So, and it also feels, I think, for counter protesters, like a bit of a slap in the face to say this. You're being blamed, you know, at that point for the violence that came upon you. So I think it had the effect on both sides of backfiring.
Other members of President Trump's administration, though, have used stronger language in their responses. Here is Vice President Mike Pence.
We have no tolerance for hate and violence from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, or the KKK. These dangerous fringe groups have no place in American public life and in the American debate, and we condemn them in the strongest possible terms.
However, Vice President Pence did defend Trump's words, saying that the president clearly and unambiguously condemned what happened in Charlottesville. Your thoughts on that, Cynthia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that many of the statements that are coming out after Trump's statement and realizing that was too vague, you know, have become unambiguously stronger, and that's a good thing to see that kind of condemnation come out. But I think, you know, I think it also needs to be said that yes, while you condemn violence, but by saying that it's that it's attributable to many sides that had the effect of legitimizing on the one side and also feeling like you were blaming the victims who were had a car plowed into them for bringing violence upon them. And that's kind of, there's a long history of blaming victims of violence in all kinds of ways that that just dredges up. And so I think it's important to, on the one hand, continue to condemn the violence, but not to legitimize the way in which that was condemned in vague terms on Saturday by Trump himself.
Yeah, and there are those who say that President Trump needs to, in his own words, once again condemn, and specifically condemn the hate and violence from the white supremacists and the alt-right side, and he should do so from the Oval Office. He should do so from the White House. We thought that he was going to hold a presidential press conference today, but according to NPR, that press conference is not going to happen. How important is it, do you think, for us to hear from President Trump again on this today?
I think it is important. I think, you know, we know from research in other settings overseas in Europe that the language that political leaders use really matters. When they use language that dehumanizes immigrants, that dehumanizes people who have physical differences, you know, that those kinds of things lead to a legitimation of violence and anger and more extremism. We know that that fuels extremism. So not having a kind of unequivocal statement from political leaders condemning violence and also specifically honing in on who's responsible for that violence and condemning those groups is problematic. We do need that.
Before we take our break and welcome in callers, and we have many of them, I wanted to ask you about Vice President Pence said these fringe groups or this fringe group. How fringe is this movement? Your forthcoming book is The Extreme Gone Mainstream.
Right. Yeah, I think the groups themselves are fringe. I think that's accurate. I think, you know, what I found over the course of the work I was doing is that what I considered to be previously fringe, kind of niche, small, subcultural groups have become more mainstream, and that's happening in a couple of different ways. On the one hand, the rhetoric has become mainstream, so the kinds of things, the kind of language that's been used has become more normative, but there's also more the groups themselves, you know, to be marching across a university campus with torches, you know, to be the kinds of things we've seen across university campuses. My own campus had swastikas and had a hate crime in the spring that the FBI is investigating, you know, that kind of frequency with which groups feel confident about the acts that they're doing, whether that leads to direct violence or is limited to, you know, kind of the papering of white supremacist flyers around university campuses. That's the kind of mainstreaming that we're seeing that is undeniable. It's just much more out in the open compared to what was happening even a year and a year and a half ago.
We are talking with Cynthia Miller Idris, who is an associate professor of education and sociology at American University, where, among other things, she researches extremism. Her forthcoming book is The Extreme Gone Mainstream. And she is talking with us about the issues raised by this weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia. One person was killed, 19 others injured when an Ohio man drove his car into a group of counter-demonstrators at a white supremacist rally. What do you think of what happened? What's your reaction? What's your reaction to President Trump's response? And what do you think can or should be done about hate and extremism in America? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Hey, Wisconsin, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A from WAMU and NPR. Join me this afternoon as we take an honest look at America, bringing context and insight to stories unfolding across the country and around the world. Politics, technology, pop culture, you'll find them all on 1A, Monday through Thursday afternoons at 1, here on the Ideas Network.
Deuce. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about that white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that turned violent over the weekend. Rally attendees, which included members of the alt-right and neo-Nazi movements, clashed with protesters, resulting in three deaths. Two were law enforcement officers who died when their helicopter crashed. One was a young woman who was killed when an Ohio man allegedly rammed his car into a group of counter-protesters. One person killed and more than 19 injured. So what do we make of this? What can we do about this rise in hate and extremism? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Cynthia Miller Idris, an associate professor of education and sociology at American University. She is coming out with a book, The Extreme Gone Mainstream. You know, Cynthia, I mentioned that what do we do about this rise in hate and extremism? Is there a rise in hate and extremism in this country?
Well, there's a rise in the visibility of hate and extremism in this country. So I think that it's still an open question whether people are actually, you know, joining groups or engaging in violence in greater levels. Are they motivated to join more? But for sure, there is a rise. There's been a rise in hate crimes. There's been a rise in hate incidents. There's a rise in people of color and Muslims and in other minority groups talking about their sense of vulnerability. In the reports of anti-Semitic episodes. So, yes, there's definitely a rise in that, whether that means people themselves, you know, whether we're just legitimizing and activating that, or whether there's also changes in attitudes that show that more people are entering those groups, we don't really know yet.
Let's take some calls. Nikki in East Troy is with us. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a subject that honestly has been on my mind forever, I would honestly think. I just find it really heartening and very sad that we have a president that cannot admit to his own country, to his own people, that this was a domestic terrorist attack. And he criticizes all these other countries and all these other groups like ISIS and the terrorist attack that happened in France, but he will not admit it here. It heartens me that it's barely on the news. You read it most about Facebook, the fact that it's called a rally and not a riot. If this was a Black Lives Matter thing, it probably would have been a riot protest. But this was actually a riot. They came here with guns. They came with protection gear, everything, as the counter-ralliers didn't even have any of that. No violence or nothing, just to protest what we feel, how they felt. And they came here with tiki torches and guns. Are you kidding me? This was planned. They wanted violence to happen to make their statement, to let everyone in this country know that they are still here. Racism has never died. It has only been taught from generation to generation, and it has unfortunately been passed down. And now we have a president with pretty much almost half of his cabinet accepting this and barely calling it for what it was. It's a terrorist attack against this country, pretty much. And I'm afraid that we're going to have a Civil War II at the same time that we're going to have a World War III. And it's honestly scary to be living in this country at the same time. We criticize all of these other countries, but we cannot do it to our own.
All right. A lot there, Cynthia, but what's your response?
Yeah, I mean, I sympathize. I think there is a lot of uncertainty about, you know, people are using the language. You have heard the language and the rhetoric from political leaders also about the phrase of civil war. You know, I don't think we're headed toward a civil war in reality, but I do think that we are facing a society that's more and more divided than it ever has been, and political leadership has to step up and start to realize that the kind of language that was used in the campaign that dehumanized, that kind of legitimized kind of feelings of rejection, of a loss of white identity, of all the kind of fear of immigrants, that has unleashed now a kind of actual violence that has to be reined back in, and that part of reining that back in is condemnation from political leaders, and part of it is defining it as domestic terrorism. I think that's absolutely right. I think the language really matters, and I appreciate that that point from the caller.
Yeah, thank you, Nikki, for the call. So, whose responsibility is it to fight extremism in the United States?
Well, I think I think it's a really good question. I think it's the responsibility of kind of every level. I mean, I think we're seeing local mayors really step up in a way that I think local leadership is stepping up. We're seeing this in Boston right now. You know, Boston is anticipating a rally on Boston Common next weekend in the same. With the same kind of theme, and I think we're seeing just this morning the mayor saying, you know, we're going to try to shut it down or contain it. I think we need to rely much more on local leadership, on mayors, on city leadership, on governors, to kind of explore ways to condemn, to control, to shut down these kinds of violence and the opportunities where to take advantage of rallies, of riots like this to create violence. But I also think, you know, I'm an educator. I'm in the School of Education. I do think that there's something that we need to start looking at earlier, which is how young people themselves learn to navigate diverse contexts and how to deal with diverse opinions. And we haven't really been doing a very good job of that in the school system, I would say, nationally.
Let's go next to John in Somerset. Hello, John.
Hi. I just want to say that people, these counter rally that came in there, they were bussed in there with no permit, bought and paid for by George Soros, and they brought they were cordoned off. There was only one way out of there, and they had the people right where that monument was. There was only one way out, and the cops were told to stand down by the governor and the mayor.
What's your point about this, John, about these facts that I'm not sure of completely?
George Soros bought and paid for these Black Lives Matter and the Antifa to come in there and do this.
Well, John is saying Black Lives Matter has had some blame here, I guess, Cynthia. What do you make of John's comments?
Well, I think there are always a lot of, there's the ways in which our media works right now means that there's lots of information out there that presents different theories and conspiracy theories about how things come about. I think I don't know that there's any evidence about the kind of the ways in which protesters came in or how they were organized on either side. But I think regardless, in a way, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that one person took a car and drove into a crowd of protesters, and that's the kind of we have a long tradition of peaceful protest in this country. I think we need to protect. I think that's a really important American value that I would not want to see come, get taken away. But how do you get that? How do you prevent that from escalating into violence, in which people get hurt and in this case actually died? And that's, I think, the part where what we're talking about in terms of domestic terrorism and needing to condemn that kind of violence, and condemning the groups that actually are set out to harm other people.
Yeah. What about the argument that, all right, this was a very unbalanced individual. Some of this happens on the left as well when an anti-Trump person was accused of allegedly shooting some Republican congressman a month or so ago.
Yeah. I think, he may have been unbalanced, mentally unbalanced. I think we're still learning about James Fields and his own mental history. I think that, it's not unlike what we saw with kind of young men and school shootings, in 20 mm-hmm. years ago, 15 years ago, when we saw the spate of school shootings. What we understand is that there's a whole cluster of factors that contribute to why young men in particular turn to violence to lash out against others. And part of that has to do with being mobilized by outside ideologies or rhetoric that say that they can become sort of part of something bigger or better kind of than themselves, what they deem to be bigger or better than themselves. We see this in jihadi and Islamist recruiting, and we see it in the far right as well, this idea that you can restore or contribute to something bigger or better. And I think whether he was mentally imbalanced or not, he responded to this. He's responding to a kind of mm-hmm. sense of lashing out and a way of playing a role in something bigger, and that is mobilization by extremist groups. And I think we have to understand that whether someone is mentally stable or not, are they receptive mm-hmm. to that kind of radicalization and calling out who's responsible for the kind of language that that motivates some people to undertake acts of extreme violence.
Joan in Madison is with us now. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I'm so glad I was able to get on. Donald Trump has no one to blame but himself. If everyone remembers when he was campaigning, he fired these people up with his rhetoric. It's just like David Duke said when he was on TV, that's why we voted for him. What does your guest say about that?
Do you think Trump fired up these people with his rhetoric, Cynthia?
I absolutely do. I think this is I think that's exactly what has happened, is that the campaign rhetoric has kind of unleashed, has legitimized violent racists and white supremacists to feel that their views are valid. And so, you know, when a political leader does that to appeal to particular groups, in this case, largely white young men, or white men in particular, also white women, but when you legitimize and unleash kind of that that kind of white supremacist ideology by using language that demonizes the other and scapegoats the other, it's very hard to pull that back. So whether he used it just as a campaign strategy or actually believes it himself, it's sort of beside the point. At this point, he's done it, and there has to be a way to start scaling that back. And it is absolutely, I think there's no question to me that it's attributable to the campaign rhetoric.
Yeah, and what does it say when the president appoints Steve Bannon, who has deep ties to Breitbart and the alt-right movement that way, as one of his top advisors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have the Steve Bannon campaign advisors, other advisors who on the one hand both have his ear, but also are just then celebrated, further legitimizing and celebrated by the extreme right as evidence that they that their ideas are valid. And why that turns to violence, again, that might be an issue of mental stability or not, but it's if you have mental health issues in every element of the population, and you have groups that are issuing these kinds of calls, that are rallying, that are firing up, in the caller's words, in Joan's words, firing up people like this, I think this is inevitable. And so that is an absolute consequence of the kind of rhetoric and the advisors and the people who he's brought in around him.
Yeah, well, there are plenty of rumors flying that Steve Bannon, who is the former head of the conservative news site mm-hmm. Breitbart, is on his way out. The new White House chief of staff, John Kelly, has soured on him, it says. Mm-hmm. Would that be a positive step in the right direction to fire Bannon to try to heal from what has happened?
I think it would be a positive step, but I think even more important than that is, I think that would be a positive step in the right direction. I think it would send an important signal, but I think it won't help if it's not paired with kind of strong language from the highest leadership condemning white supremacy, but also identifying it as an equivalent threat to terrorism from jihadi or Islamist groups in ways that show there's funding for this. We're going to count this as something that the Department of Homeland Security has to address, that it is a threat to national security. And I think that there are so many ways in which the Trump administration has shown that that's not the way they view. They don't view these groups as an equivalent threat. And I think that is a serious problem, because we know from the evidence that there have been more deaths attributed to far-right terrorism in the U.S. than to Islamist terrorism.
Lance in Antioch is with us. Hello, Lance.
Hello. I totally disagree with your guest. We can trace a lot of the stuff going all the way back to the 1980s. The left has had a strategy to claim that the Republican Party is a racist party. I mean, even going back to Clarence Thomas, he gets appointed to the Supreme Court, and they say, well, he's not really a black man, claiming that he's a white man when in black skin. We see this with, you know, groups like La Raza will have.
What about what happened over the weekend, Lance?
Wait a second, though. No, I'm not playing that game. The thing is,
you're talking about other stuff that we're not talking about.
No, I am talking about what you're talking about, because this is a strategy of marginalization. You try to marginalize what you call the white male. You even have it in the colleges right now where you have classes wanting white people to apologize for being white. You have went on in Evergreen College last year in Washington State, where they had a day of no whites on campus and people walking around with baseball bats.
Well, I'm glad you called, Lance, because that, Cynthia, what does
I'm
that
glad
say
you
to
called
you?
Too. Yeah. I'm glad you called too, Lance, because I think what I do think what's happening, regardless of whether there's been a long-term strategy or not, I think what's been happening in the last year and a half is something really different in the Republican Party, and I think that has to be acknowledged, that there is something different in the campaign rhetoric and the kind of language that Trump uses. But I think what's even more important about what you said is that you have honed in exactly on how a lot of the white working class males or white males are feeling that Trump is trying to appeal to this kind of, and it is this, you know, we know from research on far right mobilization what leads young men into violence. And I will say this is exactly the same cluster of factors that leads young men into, in Europe in particular, to go fight for ISIS. Is a sense of rejection, of humiliation, a loss of identity, a feeling that you're not valued, a feeling that you don't matter, economic insecurity, a whole cluster. And then someone comes along and tells you, you can be a hero, you can be part of something bigger and better than this, and there is something more meaningful out there. And I think that kind of cluster of things there's no question that that is a series of things that leads down a path toward radicalization. We know that. So, you know, that opens a whole set of other questions about what do you do about that if people are feeling that way? But I think it's really important to understand that those are the emotional underpinnings that Trump is appealing to.
Thank you, Lance, for calling. Brian in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi. Just like to briefly respond to that last and my comment, which is that everything that you just described, ma'am, the guest, also applies to Hillary Clinton's rhetoric in the last election cycle, and really to the Democrat Party and liberal movement of the last 30 years, identity politics. Come be with us because you've been marginalized by the other side and all the rest of it. So, I mean, I think it's specious, really. Much of what has been said today, trying to pin this on one political ideology or the other. I would like to point out that only a mentally unstable individual would drive a car through a group of people. At the same time, only a mentally unstable individual would throw a rock at a car. I mean, I can't fathom doing either thing or knowing anyone who would do either thing. What happened in Charlottesville was the worst among us on both sides, but the less than 1% on the right and the less than 1% on the left who are willing to use violence to try and make an ideological point, who are willing to use violence to try and force other people to agree with what they believe they should agree with. That is horrible, regardless of which side it is on. And Martin Luther King has to be rolling over in his grave. This literally, what the left and the right is doing across this nation is the opposite of what he did. I mean, his movement realized that the only way they would ever get people to listen to him, that they would win their point, that they would succeed as a movement, was by not being violent.
All right, thank you, Brian. What about Brian saying that, both sides?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that there, I you know, I agree. I think there's rhetoric on the left and the right that has called on kind of identity politics. But I do think that there has, in this particular last cycle, the last year and a half, 2 years, there has been a kind of legitimation of anti-immigration, of Islamophobia, of more of the racism that you haven't seen in previous cycles from any political party in the last, 20 years. So something different has been happening that I think has to be acknowledged. But I also think it's really important to say whether or not there was mental illness on the, whether James Fields it turns out to have mental illness, that, you know, we've seen this tactic of cars being driven in terrorist incidents across the globe, across Europe over the last couple of years, and we seem to only bring up the issue of mental instability when we're talking about the far right, right? So I think it's really important. If we're going to say that only a mentally unstable person is going to do this, then we need to talk about that mental instability across the ideological spectrum when it deals with terrorism. And I'm just not sure that's the case, you know, that we can blame it all on mental instability.
We are talking with Cynthia Miller Idris, who is an associate professor of education and sociology at American University, where, among other things, she researches extremism. Her forthcoming book is The Extreme Gone Mainstream. And we are talking about the issues raised by that white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend that turned violent, where an Ohio man drove his car into a group of counter-demonstrators, killing one woman and also injuring many others. So what's your reaction to what happened? What do you make of the president's response? What can be done about extremism in America? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We welcome your thoughts and questions and concerns following the violent clashes in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. President Trump condemned all sides for the violence in Charlottesville and is facing criticism for saying many sides are to blame instead of condemning the white supremacy aspect of this and the man who drove his car into the counter-protesters. What do you think? Should he be more forceful in condemning the white nationalists? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm wondering, Cynthia, before we go to more calls, what can everyday people and individuals do to combat hate in their own communities? There were hundreds of vigils in support of the counter-protesters being held in cities all over the nation, including one in Madison, one in Milwaukee, one in Appleton, Wisconsin, one in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So lots of vigils against the white supremacy movement.
Well, I think vigils matter. I think that visibility matters. You know, when there are people maybe who are on the fence and they start to see that there's a large outpouring of support for, you know, condemning the violence, you know, people might be more reluctant to kind of go in one direction or the other. But I also, you know, I know from my research when I did interviews with young people in Germany who had been a part of far right extremist movements or groups and then left them. And the thing that mattered the most in pulling them away from it was kind of extended interaction with somebody who was really different from them over time, you know, a brother who married somebody from another country, a teacher who was of a different ethnic group, a classmate who had come, you know, from another place. And I think that, you know, we are a really divided society. We are increasingly isolated on social media. And to the extent that people in local communities can really try through their churches, through their local groups, through their schools to have interactions with people who are different and not just isolate and demonize them, you know, you have a better chance over time at diffusing some of the anger and the hatred.
Yeah. Some argue just ignore groups like those that were rallying in Charlottesville, and they'll go home if they don't get the attention. Does it work like that?
I don't think so. I mean, I've heard that argument, too, that the media or that academics like me do more harm than good. Of course, it's something I always worry about is, are you giving more attention to groups that you know, that would die out on their own. But I actually don't think so. I think the best thing you can do is try to understand the underpinnings of hatred, to really understand where it comes from, if you want to try to develop strategies to intervene and disrupt. You know, in my case, I'm particularly interested in how to do it at earlier ages, when they're young adolescents. How can schools intervene? I think that ignoring is, you know, it has its appeals, but I think it's dangerous.
Back to the phones. Kina in Madison is with us. Hello, Kina.
Hi. First of all, I really appreciate the guest's emphasis on starting earlier in schools, et cetera. And I guess my concern is, I mean, it's pretty horrifying to see the march in Charlottesville the other day, but almost more horrifying to me is the fact that the extremists are in the White House. And the earlier caller said Martin Luther King Jr. would be rolling over in his grave. And I think that he would, to see that Jeff Sessions, while all this is going on, the Justice Department is trying to dismantle voting rights. They are racializing criminal justice and trying to roll back some of the gains that we've made. So I agree with a lot of the fear that people have expressed about seeing the extremists on the streets. But my concern is that they're in the White House and they are doing the best that they can to roll back the gains that have been made. And I'll take the comments from the author off the air. Good show.
Thank you. Cynthia?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think a lot of people share your concerns. I think that it can inspire a sense of helplessness sometimes, if you feel like there's nothing that I can do in my local community if the political leadership at the highest levels is going to roll this stuff back anyway. And I think that there's some sense of that. I mean, I would just say, you know, in my experience, the best thing that you can do is try to make change in your local community first, if you don't feel you can make changes at a national level. And it is hard, but I think there are, as I said, I think there's a place to play right now, a role to play more than perhaps ever, certainly in my own lifetime, for local mayors, for governors, for local leaders to start to kind of set out what the values of the community are and make decisions, for university leaders to say, you know, what kinds of, what are we going to stand for as a community? And I think that that's more important than it ever has been before. So I think it's easy to get very distressed by national politics, but I think there's a role for local communities and local leaders to play that we haven't even seen in the last 20 or 30 years, you know, to the same kind of degree of importance.
So what are your thoughts on whether a local leader should give a permit to a neo-Nazi group or the KKK to have a march down Main Street?
I mean, I think local leaders have to explore what the legal options are. I do think, and this is, you know, we talk about this all the time in university mm-hmm. campuses, should you be allowing, what are the restrictions on allowing particular kind of speech, you know, speakers? What are the restrictions on free speech? When does free speech become hate speech? I think that you do have to protect. I mean, one of the most important freedoms that we have is the freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech in this country. I think that's really important. But I think that when you are facing a group that is inciting violence against particular kinds of groups, or standing for something that includes the eradication of, you know, of others, or that stands for something that you can declare is against the values of a local community, I think that, and against, you know, potentially illegal, I think that's where you have to explore not issuing permits if you think that there's a public safety risk. But I think that it's important, you know, we've seen banning absolutely has backfired in a lot of places in Europe. And I think, you know, when you ban groups, it can make them more attractive. And I think that that's also really important to consider, is that, you know, straight outright banning is not necessarily a solution that works.
Back to the phones. Julie in Montello is with us. Hello, Julie.
Hi. So just a couple of points. And thank you for this discussion, because my 13-year-old at home last night was, you know, paying attention to the news, and we had a discussion. And I really think it starts in our schools and in our homes, and preaching compassion for human beings. And then just scientifically, too, and I know science is under attack, it comes down to the amount of melatonin in your skin, but we're all human beings. And just to really teach our kids that all human lives matter, and that we have to have simple, basic compassion for all human lives.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Julie. So, Cynthia, a response to that, and how do you see young people being affected by this?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a piece, an op-ed for parents about this, about how to talk to your kids about hate crimes, I think, and hate incidents. I think it's really important. You know, what I always tell young people, what I tell my own kids is, you know, is Mr. Rogers' advice after 9/11, which is, you know, look for the helpers. You keep your, you can train your gaze on the people who are running into the buildings, you know, to try to save people at that point. And I think that, you know, every time there's an incident, every time there's violence, there are way more people who are protesting. There are way more people who are standing up. And if you keep your eyes on that, it's going to give kids a sense of hope. And I think that's really important. I also think they have to have a sense of efficacy and a way to engage. And I think, you know, this idea that you can make a difference in your local community, that you can reach out to somebody who feels more vulnerable than you do, is really important. And so keeping kids, you know, gaze trained on some way in which they can make a difference in some small way is really important, because it can make them feel really hopeless, particularly if they are in a vulnerable identity group also.
Yeah. A very broad last question. What message does Charlottesville send to the rest of the world, and how can we affect it?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that, you know, the whole world has been watching. I think that there is a lot of global coverage about Charlottesville. It's a shock to the world. I think that we as a nation do have to show that we're standing up against hatred, that we're standing up against violence, that this is, whether or not this person had a mental health problem, that this isn't just an issue of mental health, but it's an issue of how violence got incited, and that we make a clear and strong demonstration against it from the political leadership, but also from local communities. I think that, I do think that's an important, you know, not just for our own country, but globally, to make it clear that that's how Americans react.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cynthia Miller Idris is an associate professor of education and sociology at American University, where, among other things, she researches extremism. Her forthcoming book is The Extreme Gone Mainstream. This hour of the Joy Cardine Show was produced by Chris Molina, August Brown, and Michelle Johnson. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Now, on a personal note, I have something I want to tell you. After 31 years working at Wisconsin Public Radio, I have decided to retire at the end of September. The past 3 decades have flown by, and I have loved almost every minute of it, but life is short, and it's time to pursue some other interests with my already retired husband. Rob and I plan to bike and hike and paddle and do yoga and travel all over Wisconsin and the world. I'll also be able to volunteer with the civic and community groups and do things that weren't possible with my early morning schedule. For more information on my plans and for the plans for this radio show, please see my letter to listeners and WPR's news release on WPR.org. And we'll also post that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. The show will go on under a different name and with a different interim host in October. And a search will pursue for a new host. So thank you for learning together with me all of these years. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network.